I think the big point is the time scale for climate action is less than a decade. We need to be talking about what changes we can do to bring emissions down quite seriously over the next handful of years. And in terms of impact, this means you can't necessarily afford to wait for the politicians you want to be in power. You can't necessarily afford to wait for other countries to do things that enable you to take climate action. Everything that needs to be done, we have the resources to do already, and it's a case of can we roll those resources out fast enough rather than waiting for something big to come along and save us in a couple of decades' time, whatever that big thing is, whether it's technological or political. We do have the tools, we do have the engineering know-how and the technology. It's a case of can we bring those to bear with what we have now.
Today, I'm joined by Dr. Robin Lamble. Robin is a research fellow at the Centre for Environmental Policy at the Imperial College London, where they research what humans emit into our atmosphere, what effects it will have on us, and what we can do about it. Robin completed a PhD in physics of solar cells at the University of Cambridge, modeling the behavior of new designs of solar cells. Robin has previously worked as a quantitative consultant and successively represented the UK in multiple international poetry slam competitions. Thank you for joining me, Robin.
Thank you for having me, Xavier.
The first question I wanted to ask, and it may warrant a longer response, but I think is definitely worth keeping note of in the context of climate discourse. 1.5 degrees is a number that may be familiar to a lot of people. It's thrown out everywhere, it's seen everywhere, and people instinctively know in the space of climate change or in the discourse that we need to maintain average levels of warming to 1.5 degrees. We need to limit it to that. But I think it's important to ask the question, why is that an important stop? Is it an arbitrary point? And what do you think the world looks like at 1.5 degrees?
Yeah, so I think it's important to say that as a number, it is not arbitrary, but it's also not this is the one number and, once you go over it, everyone dies. So 1.5 degrees is important because it's around where we see a lot of systems showing the amount of stress that is quite severe. So we're talking about systems like coral reefs, particularly where you see very frequent bleaching events, talking about levels of irreversible impact, such as glaciers melting. You start to see that in larger fractions of the globe. But it's always important to say there'll be areas where you don't see those effects, even at 1.5 degrees. There'll be areas where you see that at much lower than 1.5 degrees. Most of the impacts of climate change, things like sea level rising, things like deaths from heat waves, most of the normal impacts are relatively continuous with temperature. And so every sort of fraction of a degree is really important. But we need to have targets in international policy. And so at the time of the Paris Agreement, people came together and said, okay, 1.5 degrees is where we really start to see all these effects take off. And so that's a goal that we should aim to be below. Yeah. Then there's another goal, which is well below 2 degrees. The problem is there's not an obvious sort of round number goal between 1.5 and 2 degrees. And it's really important we don't let the Paris Agreement be reinterpreted as 2 degrees is kind of fine as long as you don't go over 2. It should be well below 2 degrees. And between 1.5 and 2 degrees, there's not really another round number to try and stay below.
What is the importance of limiting every fraction of a degree? And is there a significant difference between, let's say, 0.2 degrees of warming versus 0.1 degrees of warming after 1.5 centigrade?
I think the truth of the matter is we don't really know enough to answer that question convincingly. 0.1 of a degree, 0.2 of a degree is a very small amount in the sort of scale over which the world moves on the centuries, but it's not that much. It's a very large amount compared to what the world typically would change in a decade. And it's a sort of, we are seeing 0.2 degrees of warming per decade, which is quite frightening in many ways. So in some sense, the answer to the question is we can wait a little bit and we'll know. But at the moment, our capacity to sort of model sensitive ecosystems over sort of 0.2 2 degrees of warming is quite poor. Precautionary principle is sort of like in operation at the moment, but in order to like give a convincing answer to that question, we would need more data and more research.
Yeah, absolutely. And perhaps this is a silly question, but I definitely think it warrants elaboration. Just given the complexity of climate science, and also the range of understandings of climate science, why is it frightening that those degrees of the impacts of the degrees of warming on the environment after 1.5 degrees Celsius? I mean, given there is a lot of uncertainty, and we've modeled the fact that there is uncertainty in climate models, but why is that frightening?
So uncertainty, I think, is something that we have to tackle if, in all aspects of life. But in climate science, we only have one world, and we can't really afford to just sort of wait and see what happens to it as all these systems are suddenly changed at this rapid rate. So I think it's a problem that we have to look at models. We have to understand there may be things that aren't in the models, and we have to understand, the possibility of things changing in ways that we don't expect. So that's what's sort of frightening about these tipping points. It's important to sort of like not be captured by the uncertainty, to sort of say that yes, we don't know everything, but we can still take action based on our best estimates, our sort of current understandings of how the world works. Because we're always doing sort of cost-benefit analysis in these things, right? Climate change is not the only issue that humans have to tackle, and so when we're weighing the climate against other issues in the world and sort of political actions that can be taken, like we need to have some sort of understanding of how the climate works in order to try and like proceed with the green transition. So in terms of like how to judge very small fractions of a degree, we can look back in history at how those fractions of a degree have affected society, and you do see that even across, we've seen 1 degree of warming, 1.2 degrees of warming already across the last century and a half, and you can measure the effects of that on different ecosystems. For the main part, the first degree of warming is not going to produce sort of like these hugely unexpected effects, because most years at a sort of 1 degree warmer world will be temperatures that you will have seen before you were 1 degree warmer, because natural variability is quite high. So for a specific region, you're probably not going to be like consistently hugely far apart from your sort of normal variation range. But as we move towards 1.5 degrees, basically every year you will now be seeing temperatures which in a pre-industrial world you'd never have seen. So like you're just consistently outside the range that the ecosystem is adapted to. You're consistently outside the sort of range of temperatures that your society has probably adapted itself to. And so you can use your understanding of how things changed during that time, but you just have to be aware that maybe things will start changing non-linearly as you sort of enter this regime of consistent surprise.
Definitely. And I mean, I think a really important thing to note, which you mentioned at the end, just after we go past 1.5 degrees, the ecosystems, animal life, all those sorts of fascinating topics, the threshold at which they're used to adapt to, it passes that threshold. And so you see all sorts of species extinction, deformation, other catastrophes as such. And there's a climate scientist that worked previously on the IPCC reports, who is an Australian climate scientist called Joelle Gergis, and she mentions that in terms of the to put the perspective of the rate of warming that we're experiencing, I think she mentioned something along the lines of on a geological scale, the rate of warming that we're experiencing is warming that is on par or equivalent to warming that previously occurred over thousands of years. What we're doing, essentially the equivalent of thousands of years and essentially a century and a bit more than that. And yeah, that is very frightening. And at the same time, your research, which you've published, has worked towards figuring out what we can do about that. But also, I wanted to reference your carbon budgeting paper, which I think is a really good way of us figuring out we have this much carbon left to emit. if we want to maintain our policy goals. But I'll before we even jump into that, I wanted to give you the floor to explain what your research is showing with regards to carbon budgets. And if maybe I would encourage you to share, what is a carbon budget and what are you seeing?
Yeah. So the carbon budget is just a way of translating between like science speak, where we want to know how much the world will warm, and policy speak, where people want to know how much carbon they can emit in order and while still avoiding certain temperature limits. So, for instance, in the Paris Agreement, we said we will try and pursue efforts to limit warming to below 1.5 degrees and well below 2 degrees. So, what does that mean in terms of actual carbon that we can emit? It turns out that temperatures are mostly not dependent on when carbon is emitted because it stays in the atmosphere for a long period of time. And a weird coincidence means that the way in which it leaves the atmosphere means the warming sort of remains in the atmosphere, which means that you can basically estimate the warming as being proportional to cumulative emissions over a sort of century timescale. So that means if you want to keep your temperature below, let's say 1.5 degrees, then you can simply say what's that increase in temperature per unit CO2 emitted, and then divide by that, and you get the total amount of carbon you can still emit before you reach net zero. One of the interesting features just to come out of the existence of this number is the importance of net zero, at least something very approximately close to net zero. At the moment, we're still neglecting all of the other emissions. Once you start taking account of all the other emissions, it gets a little more complicated. But approximately, we need to be at net zero before warming stops. And so, policies that don't get us to net zero are kind of a not going to deliver a stop in global warming. And the other really valuable thing about this number is, of course, that it gives us a sort of time scale over which we need to make our climate goals sort of felt. And that time scale is of the order decades. So we would probably say a conclusion from our paper is that there are 6 years, and by now, basically 5 years since we've had most of one of those years of emissions before we would have extinguished our entire 1.5 degree budget. Not that we'll necessarily be at 1.5 degrees in 5/6 years, but that there will be nothing you could do at that point that would prevent warming from taking you to 1.5 degrees. So although the uncertainty on this is relatively large, so it could be easily almost nothing or almost double that, the time scale is of the order like less than a decade, which is it's quite short by the standards of most policy, right? Given that historically we have not been that successful at reducing emissions on sort of decade or time scales.
Yeah, 6 years doesn't sound like a lot of time, and implementation of climate policy, at least locally, and I mean, this is a story I'm sure is the same in the United Kingdom, is that it's probably not very fast over there either, I imagine, and most places around the world. I know that certain countries, certain c counties, and even city councils that are leading the way, but in terms of national policy, implementation is slow. On that front, if every country implemented their current pledges, and I don't know if this is something that you can answer, but if every country implemented their current climate pledges, where would that lead us? Just to get a sense of current where policy is in terms of the current science.
So we actually had a paper out on this, which was saying, okay, if everyone has their current pledges, and some of these pledges are conditional on aid being given to them to financially support developing countries who need finance basically to enable them to roll out green technology. If all of that was met, we would be probably around the 2 degree mark. So we're probably not yet Paris compliant, but we're also not a million miles away from being that below 2 degrees key target. Certainly not well below, but like probably below is our best estimate. Unfortunately, it doesn't look like most governments are fulfilling their agreements, both in the sense of like their actual emissions decline. Some countries are. Some countries, I think Australia largely manages this by having extremely mild commitments. The UK has just about been keeping to its commitments in terms of local policy, but hasn't been delivering on its commitments for climate finance for developing nations. And as a result, we essentially see that some of those policies just don't really seem to be applying at the moment. On the whole, a lot of countries have policies that are for quite far in the future, so it's hard to be sure how we are doing for them. But unfortunately, we don't have very much by way of concrete policy at the moment that would lend support for those coming through, just because there's quite a long timeline between you put policy out, companies have to react to that policy, they change how they do business, grids change, all these sorts of things. And that just takes a sort of many years for, you know, ideas for policy to feed through into like actual things that reduce emissions.
Well, I mean, with all that in mind, Robin, so you've mentioned that, based on your research, we have about 6 years. We have a certain amount of pollution that we can emit, the CO2 we can emit. And after we emit that level of CO2, that is the point at which we cannot limit warming below 1.5 degrees anymore. So we will go over. In terms of the confidence in the research based on all the uncertainties, how confident are you in this specific figure based on your colleagues in terms of consensus in the scientific community? Is this a figure that we've seen before that you've come to in terms of relatively similar figures? I'm sure it's not exact, but what does that look like?
Yeah. So previously, the IPCC released a figure which was sort of at the time 12 years, but that was 3 years ago. So 3 of those years have simply happened. And during those 3 years, emissions didn't substantially come down. There was COVID, which brought it down a bit in 2020, but then they pinged back up. And unfortunately, they kept rising last year, and it looks like they're rising again this year. There's some signs that the rate of increase is much below what it was previously, and so maybe they will start coming down in a few years. There was a report that came out last week suggesting that maybe this is the year of peak emissions, but it's not really projecting the emissions to decline rapidly. It's really more projecting a sort of leveling off of emissions. Is 3 years much of an update when you sort of say 12 minus 3 minus 3? No, not really. The physics changed a little bit as we came to understand the impact of aerosols is slightly larger than we expected, but it's not much larger than a rounding error in when you consider the uncertainty that we reported in the first place. It's well within the original uncertainty. I think there was already quite a lot of evidence in the field suggesting that the budget should be smaller. The IPCC puts out several different reports. The earliest report is the one that's responsible for the carbon budget. And I should say it was the same people doing the calculation all the way through. It's just that you know we came up with better answers as the science became more settled from the work of Working Group One. The problem is they're trying to do lots of different areas of science all at the same time. And so it takes a little while for all the science to sort of percolate down and for the models to be developed using the data that's assembled during the process of writing the report. So by the time it came to the third report from this, it's known as AR6, the IPCC's like big report number six, we sort of knew at this point already that actually we should have lost about 3 years worth of emissions due to the effects of aerosols. And then we hinted at this in the Working Group 3 report, and then this work was just to try and like solidify, you know, what it should be exactly and do some robustness checks to make sure, you know, are we going to have to update it again actually next year? Probably better if we didn't have to too much. So we now include more different climate models to try and make sure that the answer is more robust. But fundamentally, no, it's not a big surprise to people in the field.
And in terms of coming up with the, I suppose, the annual amount of emissions that we can emit, obviously that's a number that we come up with in terms of annually, how much do we emit? So as I understand, you could probably do a linear way of determining how much to emit every year, where you say, okay, if we have 100 million gigatons of carbon and we have 6 years left, then we can do, this much every year. So it's, I guess it's the same every year, right? Or you could do something where you have a large amount in the earlier years, and then you steeply reduce the amount that we can emit in the later years. How do we determine what the best way is, or if there is a best way? I'm not too sure, but how do we determine that?
So if you want to say what the best way is, you need to go into sort of economics, because it now depends on like what is the best way of rearranging your power grid. And so they have these models called integrated assessment models, or IAMs, that are designed to answer that question. You can say, here's our allowed carbon budget. Tell me what is the best pathway to go about doing that. And typically you get some results out very consistently. Like as soon as you switch the models into like this optimization process, they go, why on earth are you burning all this coal? This is crazy. Stop that immediately. And then you have to sort of like hard code in, no, actually, realistically, they're not going to stop that immediately. Let's allow them to settle it down slowly. Whereas there are other things that's like different models will report very differently on like what is the sort of like cost optimal way of doing it. But typically, they do suggest like very rapid initial reduction, because there's so many low-hanging fruits like coal, for instance. Like it's very expensive relative to the amount of energy you get out of it. It's very polluting for air quality reasons. And it's just really very cheap to try and push actually most of the coal out of systems where that's still being burnt. Whereas like gas is sort of later to transition. So the timeline is very different for different bits of the energy system. It's quite a complicated economics problem. The carbon budget is basically an exercise in trying not to have to answer that question in detail, and still give a number so that people who have that question can sort of like get a gist of what the climate science says, and then use that for their economics models.
Right, and I imagine carbon, but this is certainly not the first time a carbon budget has occurred has been conducted. What have we done previously? Because I mean, I find it very interesting that the humanities, or perhaps social sciences like economics, or I mean, some people may take issue with the framing of economics as such, but as playing such a significant role in determining essentially how much of carbon can be used on an annual basis. And yet I would argue that the previous ways of working haven't been necessarily successful. Perhaps that's just a layman's perspective, but I would be interested to see what you think. And then also, what have we done in the past with previous carbon budgets in terms of.
So the truth of the matter is that the way that the carbon budget works, which is the way that physics works, has not been very well integrated to government processes. Governments really like targets for years, and that's just not quite the way that physics works. And this allows delayed reactions in a way that we do see. So you see, Shell, for instance, is telling people that it's compatible with the Paris Agreement because it sets a net zero date of 2050. It doesn't really matter what they do until 2050 in this sort of like net zero target year. And that's not at all how physics works. We care about the cumulative emissions until you get to net zero. But unfortunately, like this policy, this insight just doesn't make its way into policy. And people just do allow you to get away with saying, okay, but if we're at net zero by this year in the future, and have some vague pathway that indicates that we might actually get there, then we can call ourselves Paris compliant. So you're right that this is being used in economics modeling, but the economics modeling based on physics is not the modeling that is actually used by most governments, and even by organizations that are designed to check Paris compliance, unfortunately. The problem often is that the wrong like lessons have been taken from the carbon, like the same framework that gave us the carbon budget. So people came up with all these models. People used net zero years in the models, the integrated assessment models, and then didn't look at the other assumptions that were required for this. That was assuming that people were doing this cost optimal thing where you have rapid decline in the near term and then take a long time to get to net zero exactly because you've got these emissions that are harder to mitigate and more expensive to mitigate. But that's not what people have been doing. So if you were to try and translate this into what people are actually doing, you'd need to mitigate much faster than that.
Yes, and I can see how this is certainly a very big cause of distress and even frustration amongst climate scientists. And I think it's also a problem with or a challenge that scientists around the world have, with climate scientists especially, in terms of how to convey the insights of the discipline across different disciplines, and then also if there is a gap, a knowledge gap between two disciplines, how do we integrate both of them together to come up with some sort of optimal, some sort of synthesis, right? Do you have a sense of how the one? Okay, I'll reduce the burden. Do you have a sense of one of the ways in which we could best implement the insights of your carbon budget in a way
It's focus on the whole journey, I think, is the big site. Like, it's not all about the year at which you arrive at net zero. You need to account for what you're doing in every year along the way. And so that means that if you have an update like we've had in the last year, oil prices went up, several oil companies were like, well, that means we're going to be producing more oil in the intervening years, but we'll still keep the net zero for the year that we previously had it. We'll wave our hands a bit and imply that we'll do some more work in the future with our very large amounts of money that we have as a result of all the increased sales that we're going to do now. From a physics perspective, that doesn't work at all. But if all you do is say you have to reach net zero by this year, that does work. But if you've got this whole sort of like journey perspective, like the fact that you're emitting more in the near term obviously means you'll have to move your net zero date back or have much steeper declines in the near term. And if you don't have a policy for that, you just shouldn't be allowed to say that you're Paris compliant anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds pretty straightforward, and I'm and at the same time, perhaps that is, or that definitely doesn't seem like the way things are laid out in policy, at least. In terms of coming back to warming, so a really interesting research article I read a few weeks ago was talking about the role that dust plays in reducing average temperatures. And so this is similar to other aerosols that have a cooling effect on the total temperature of the Earth. But the interesting insight from that is not, oh, cool, dust is awesome. The insight is, as we progress with trying to be stricter in terms of the amount of aerosols we release into the environment, as we become stricter in terms of environmental protection, environmental policy, reducing pollution, and perhaps reducing the amount of dust in the atmosphere, that's going to reduce those non-CO2 pollutants into the environment. And so that's going to paradoxically, well, not paradoxically, but interestingly, increase the amount of warming. Meaning to say, as I understand, that warming is actually worse, or it's than it is ostensibly recorded. Is that correct? And
Yes.
how does this account into the carbon budget?
So yeah, that's basically correct. Dust here is I guess so a common way of describing like a whole bunch of things, which includes both literal bits of soot and other sort of particulate matter, like bits of sand from the desert, but also sulfates is another big class of chemicals that cause like water to form on them, which then makes sulfuric acid. And these are known as aerosols, and this whole class of chemicals does cause the cooling that you establish, both just directly because it's kind of scatters light as it comes in, and also because of how it changes cloud formation, which then also clouds scatter light as well. And it's reasonably well established that this has a cooling effect. It has historically probably had more of a cooling effect due to basically the fact that we've had aerosol controls come in. In recent years, we've had controls on aerosol emissions from ships. Historically, we had very high levels of aerosol emissions from coal burning in the UK. We've been sweeping that down, whereas other places around the world have been increasing their coal burning, and aerosols therefore have sort of shifted from Europe to the Far East and other places around the world. On the whole, this does have the cooling effect that you described. So as we wind down things like coal burning, we expect to see some of that cooling unmasked, and therefore there's a net heating effect. The exact strength of this effect is debated, as in, it could easily be substantially more or substantially less than we think, although there are experiments that show limit the extent of it. So, for instance, during COVID, we saw a reduction in aerosols, and that year wasn't like very much hotter than you'd expect. Whereas this current year is much hotter than would be expected, given just simple temperature trends. And one of the reasons for that may well be that there was an unusually low level of dust picked up over the Sahara Desert, which is in combination with effects like a reduction of emissions from shipping and possibly other effects to do with volcanic activity, resulting in this unusual temperature. So yeah, we do include that in the model, and actually an update to our understanding of the strength of that effect was responsible for the 3 years of change in the target before you get to net zero. And yeah, we just have to keep an eye on the science around that. As we get more data over time, we can set better constraints on how high or low that effect is, which means you might have even more rapid climate action necessary. Yeah, but it's just very much a matter of ongoing research.
Do you think there's a risk that the role that aerosols and things like dust play in the wider discourse will begin to heavily risk meeting certain policy goals, and so a reduction or aiming to mitigate those non-CO2 pollutants is actually taken off the table in the interest of maintaining temperature, maintaining warming at a reasonable level? Or do you see that as really depending on the uncertainty and depending on where we are, we will adjust accordingly in the future?
Yeah, so the aerosol effect is not proportional to the cumulative emissions over time, whereas the CO2 warming effect is proportional to cumulative emissions. So for aerosols, you've got to emit new ones every year in order to keep the effect there. This has a problem with if you try and keep the status quo. Yes, you keep up the level of aerosols, but you'll have to emit more every year that you keep emitting CO2. So some people are suggesting using this effect for a sort of geoengineering. That's a very controversial topic, but what you can say with a relatively high degree of certainty is doing that well before you're reaching net zero is not a good strategy for maintaining current temperatures, because you'll be locked into having to emit ever higher levels of these aerosols, which cause acid rain, cause health concerns, all these sorts of things. Whether there's an advantage to releasing like a relatively small amount of it, just like as we are reaching net zero, it's a technique known as peak lopping, because you're sort of like just trying to chop the top off your temperature curve. Maybe there's a role for that. That's an active area of debate. But at the moment, I think most of the debate is not really around that. It's around, as you say, thinking we could ju just do this and then maintain levels of emissions. What also has been suggested is that we just try a bit less hard at some of the environmental legislation, for instance, like the shipping legislation. So this legislation said you can keep burning the fuel that you currently burn in your ships, which is releasing the CO2 that was traditionally burning, but we're going to put that the emissions through a scrubber, which just scrubs out some of the sulfates. So you can just sort of like dial up or down the level of sulfates without fundamentally changing the CO2 emitted very much. Now, if you think that sulfates are sort of like saving us by maybe more than expected, that sounds like a really terrible decision, because you're like, okay, so we lose some of that benefit of the sulfate, and you still have the CO2. So that's just like a really bad situation to be in. It's like the worst of both worlds. If you're more concerned about the health impacts of those sulfates, which can be substantial, certainly if there are people around you, then you'd be concerned about that. Maybe when you're very far out to sea, you're less bothered by the health impacts of the sulfates, but you still have the acid rain, which is like not great for the oceans. Then maybe you'd be sort of like more on the actually, no, this legislation is still net good. It's just we need to be aware of this effect. But in the long run, when you reach net zero, levels of aerosols released should be lower anyway, just because so much less of your energy comes from burning things. So at some point, you're going to get this sort of unmasking effect. It's just a question of when it kicks in. And as I say, you might be able to use this effect to prevent like going over like some particular temperature goal, but in the long run, your temperatures would still match either way.
I think we've quite comprehensively covered the carbon budget. We've covered why we need to reach 1.5 degrees, and we've covered how much time we have essentially before we blow over that that budget. In terms of impacts, in ter de depending on the types of scenarios, we briefly mentioned at the beginning tipping points. I think it may warrant an explanation. Could you explain, what tipping points are essentially, and how imminent they might be given the current trajectory?
So a tipping point is simply something about the Earth system, which once it's swung from one state to another state, it will lock into that state for like geological time periods. So a very simple example of this might be a glacier. If there's a glacier, like it's been there for thousands of years, but once it melts, it will take millions of years to build up again. And we are at a state where we are losing an awful lot of glaciers around the world. Each of those glaciers is in some sense a tipping point. But usually we talk about tipping points to mean sort of larger scale objects than glaciers. So perhaps, for instance, a large fraction of the Antarctic ice sheet. And we're talking about the Earth being a very large, complex system. There are hundreds of different tipping points on it. Some of those tipping points have probably already tipped. So many of those individual glaciers already doomed because you have feedback effects. Whereby, even if there's still some of the glacier, as the glacier shrinks, it's reflecting less light. The mountain around it heats up more, therefore, more of it melts, and at some point, it becomes irreversible. There's now some evidence that some parts of Antarctica are in this state whereby they're losing ice in a way that it looks like it's reaching a positive feedback effect. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to lose that ice over sort of like a decade or timescale. And for most policy questions, we are not really interested in the sort of like multi-century to millennium timescale. We're interested in sort of like 10 years to 100 years. And it's not clear that many of the very large tipping points are tipping on that timescale. So for policy questions and for the carbon budget, we can avoid quite a lot of these tipping point questions just by setting the parameters that we're interested in. But certainly, if you're a geologist, you're going to be very worried about a lot of these tipping points. And in terms of the Earth's long-term temperature trajectory, a lot of these tipping points probably come into play. So some of these tipping points are just ice-based things, so melting of various glaciers, thawing of permafrost. And some of those tipping points might have feedback effects for the planet as a whole. So when an individual glacier goes, then the like whiteness of the Earth slightly decreases, so it absorbs slightly more energy. For one mountain, that's probably not that big a deal. But when you're talking about very large areas, this probably has some feedback effect in terms of the Earth's temperature. We do try to include this in models, but the way that we include it might be wrong. So we have some worry that we need to take account of this, like having unexpected side effects that are much larger than we think. And we talk about this as a sort of like tail risks of climate change, that there are some of these feedback effects that are substantially larger than we currently estimate. I think it's important not to get too caught up in a lot of these tail risks because, as I say, often, even when there are tipping points, they sound very scary, but realistically, the timescales of them are quite long and there's not very good evidence for most of them. But it's important not to sort of like worry about the things that are very low probability, high impact, when you've got so many things that are very high probability, high impact already in your sort of probability space. And I think because like the tipping points are sort of like the exciting
Yeah.
like big
They're
like
the
boogeyman,
blockbuster film.
people often get very obsessed with them and miss out the fact that like very standard cost-benefit analysis, not including these things, like has like points in very much the same direction. Like, you can think about it as like here, if you do what's rational according to like a very simple climate climate models which don't have all these effects and very simple economic models
Yeah.
that don't have all these boogeymen in them, you also get the same action, like climate action, being very relevant and optimal. It's also an insurance event, an insurance against these boogeymen being real. But you shouldn't like allow all of your climate activism to be like held captive by the question of whether or not some of these extreme things are or aren't real. Like, it's interesting to discuss, it's interesting to keep track of, but like the probabilities on the whole aren't that high, and it's sort of like possibly a distraction that can lead to people being like very doomerist or thinking like, okay, it's too late, we're all going to die, or like it doesn't really matter what we do at this point because it's already like all these tipping points have gone. And like possibly they have, but like we have centuries to worry about like getting back to like if we're talking about temperatures being able to return to below 1.5 degrees, well, let's prevent it from going above 1.5 degrees first before we worry about like do we need to like reduce to pre-industrial temperatures to stabilize things.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, in a sense, it's, investing too much energy on these certain tail events, black swan events, whatever you want to call them, that are, in sense, on a probability scale or on a certain, in a certainty scale, we don't know, have enough information about, nor is it, should it be our primary focus, given that there's much greater risks that we have that we know are going to occur with much higher certainty. Now, as a very, very last question, and perhaps it'll warrant a longer answer, but I invite you to answer this in as few words as possible. With all of the what we've just discussed, what is the bottom line or the big takeaways from the research you and your colleagues have conducted?
I think the big point is the time scale for climate action is less than a decade. We need to be talking about what changes we can do to bring emissions down quite seriously over the next handful of years. And in terms of like impact, this means you can't necessarily afford to wait for the politicians you want to be in power. You can't necessarily afford to wait for like other countries to do things that enable you to take climate action. Like, everything that needs to be done, we have the resources to do already, and it's a case of can we roll those resources out fast enough, rather than waiting for something big to come along and save us in a couple of decades' time, whatever that big thing is, whether it's technological or political. Like, we do have the tools, we do have the engineering know-how and the technology. It's a case of can we bring those to bear with what we have now.
Brilliant. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up. So I'd like to say thank you very much, Robin, for joining me. Please stay with me in the green room, the virtual green room.
Thank
But
you.
again, if anyone wants to find your work, where can they find it? Or if you would like to promote anything, please feel free to do so.
Yeah, I'm just on various social media as Robin Lamble.
Great. Well, thank you again, Robin.
Thank you.